The following talk, Avoiding Cromwell, was given at a Progressive Roundtable discussion sponsored by the Madison Institute in Madison, Wisconsin, on January 20, 2007. The speaker, Dr. John P. Kaminsky, is director of the Center for the Study of the American Constitution in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. In this masterful and entertaining talk, Kaminsky reviews the English-speaking people's efforts to protect their rights, from Magna Carta to the American Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Dr. John Kaminsky.
The rights of the British were in the common law, and they only wrote down their rights when their rights were violated by the king. And you get these great documents, Magna Carta, the Petition of Rights, the Bill of Rights, and various acts. These are all responses to violations of rights by the monarch, saying to the monarch, don't violate our rights again, otherwise we won't support you. But it's always fascinated me that in all the kings that the British have had, they've only had one King John. No one wants to be King John II because they remember King John and Magna Carta. And the rights of the barons were put in Magna Carta. And so this is one of the first of the major documents, 1215, Magna Carta. King John violated the rights of the barons. And that document is referred to regularly throughout all of British history and American history as an example of the executive, the monarchy, abusing the rights of his people. The next prominent example of an English king violating the rights of individuals came about with the Stuart kings. When Elizabeth I died, she had no heir. And the Stuart family was then named King James I. It was known as the Child King. He was 36 years old. Why would you call him a child king? Well, he had been king of Scotland for 35 years already. He became king when he was 1 year old. And he and his son, who followed him, Charles I, had a sense of autocratic rule. They wanted to rule the way Louis XIV ruled in France at the time. Well, the English didn't quite agree with that kind of philosophy. They'd gone beyond that, and Parliament had considerable powers, especially the House of Commons. And so when Charles I tried to institute new taxes, they weren't new taxes, they were old taxes that had been used hundreds of years before, but they had not been used for many, many years, and he couldn't get parliamentary approval of new taxes, so he created these old taxes. And if you didn't pay these taxes, they were in various forms. If you were an aristocrat, a baron, you'd be thrown into prison. If you were a commoner and didn't pay the taxes, you'd be drafted into the army. And so there was a great deal of discontent with Charles I, so much so that civil war occurred. And in that civil war, that lasted for almost 10 years, you had the Puritan House of Commons opposing Charles I and the Cavaliers, the supporters of monarchy. The Puritan House of Commons created a new model army. And this is an army that is religiously founded, and it has a great deal of moral fiber in it, and it also has factions that are advocating social improvement. You have the leveler movement, in essence trying to get rid of this highly stratified class society of England at the time. The new model army was led by Oliver Cromwell. That's my title, Avoiding Cromwell. And Cromwell was successful, and the monarchists were defeated. Charles I was captured and executed in a legitimate trial. the English people like to legitimize their revolutions and their rebellions, and lawyers are often called upon to contribute in this regard. This was the case not only in the English Civil War and the Glorious Revolutions a little bit later, but also in the American Revolution on constitutional grounds. But when Cromwell was successful and the king was deposed and then executed, the English wrote for the first time in their history, the only time in their history, they wrote a written constitution.
And when was that?
That was in 1649. You get the instrument of government, a written constitution, which eliminates the monarchy, eliminates the House of Lords. You only have the House of Commons. But it didn't take very long before the House of Commons violated the instrument of government. And so what does Cromwell do? He takes control of the new model army again. He has himself named Lord Protector, not King, but Lord Protector, and he rules with an iron fist until he dies. He has his lieutenant general stationed strategically throughout the country, and it is probably more despotic than the rule of Charles I. And so when Cromwell died in 1658, his son tried to maintain authority, but there was an uprising against him, and eventually Charles II from France was recalled out of exile, the son of Charles I, and the monarchy was reestablished, as was the House of Lords. Cromwell's body was dug up, his head was severed, and put on a pike, the proper treatment of a traitor. And so, what we have in America is Benedict Arnold. We know his treasonous activities during the American Revolution. He was a great American general, and then he turned traitor. And so, he is our example of what a traitor is. In Great Britain, Cromwell is the one that they point to as the one who has abused his authority. The hero who turns against the people. And this is what George Washington tried to avoid. At the end of the American Revolution in 1783, Washington became immortal in the eyes of his contemporaries when he wrote his last letter to the states, a circular letter, in which he outlined what had to be done for America to stay great and what he was going to do. He was going to retire, never to serve in public again. He became known as the American Cincinnatus, named after the Roman general who was called in the military to lead in the war they were involved in at the time. And he was successful. And after the victory, he went home to his farm. That's what George Washington did. He did not want to be Cromwell. He did not want to use his authority to become king or some other kind of executive authority and rule arbitrarily. And so he went home. Well, the American people understood their English history. They saw what happened with the reestablishment of the monarchy, Charles II and James II, then his brother. They ruled, and they had flirtation with Catholicism. Catholicism at that time in England was viewed the way we sort of viewed the radical Islamic activities of Iran when they captured our hostages that were there. And so when Charles II flirted with the Catholics, trying to eliminate the laws that had been passed that would restrict their freedom of religion, and when James II, Charles's brother, ascends to the throne, James is a Catholic. This is a very dangerous thing for Englishmen to imagine. And so they try to pass various measures that would prohibit James II from ascending to the throne. They fail because of the authority of the crown. Charles I would not allow these measures to be passed. He would either suspend Parliament or he would add to the members of the House of Lords so that they would not agree to what was being passed. So you had different kinds of strategies by the monarch, by the executive, that would forestall the ascension of James II to the throne. But when James II became king, and when his wife had a male heir, that was the last straw that broke the camel's back, and you get the Glorious Revolution in 1688, 1689, where James is deposed, and his Protestant daughter and her husband from the Netherlands, William III, came, and they were given the monarchy if they would agree to certain stipulations, including a Bill of Rights. And this is sort of a watershed in English history where you get the conflict between the prerogative of the king and the authority of Parliament in conflict, and now Parliament is supreme. When William and Mary die, their daughter, Anne, becomes queen. She has no heir. And this is a very controversial time in the early 1700s. And the Act of Settlement is passed in 1701. This act is an important act in that it says there will be no Catholic heir to the throne. And when Anne dies, they have to go over more than 30 individuals to get a Protestant king. They would rather, and what they chose was George I, a Hanoverian king, a German. He never lived in England. He couldn't speak English. They'd rather have a German king, a Protestant German king, than a Catholic Englishman being king. And that's what they got. George I and George II, both German kings, couldn't speak English, didn't live in England, and they were viewed as very weak. And in that vacuum, Parliament asserts its authority. And you have the struggle for power between the political parties, the Tories and the Whigs. It's not until 1760, when George II dies, that his grandson, George III, becomes king. And George III is the perfect king. He is now an Englishman. He's lived in England. He is tall, and he is handsome, and he is powerful and athletic. He's exactly what you want to have as a king. And he becomes king. He's very popular, and he then rules. And he is loved and adored by everyone, including Americans. The problem is, very shortly after George III ascends the throne, the French and Indian War, the 7 Years' War, the Great War for Empire, same war, it's called different names by in different places, that ends in 1763. And the British have a new policy toward America. This is going to be, have a changed relationship, a changed administration. And it's going to have a much closer relationship. The colonies, 12 of the 13 American colonies, were established during the reign of the Stuart kings, between 1607 and 1688. Only Georgia was established afterwards. And so during that time, when you had the English Civil War and then the Glorious Revolution, these internal concerns, and then in the 7th and the 18th century, when you had the first, you had four world wars. They were imperial wars between England on the one hand and France and Spain on the other hand. So throughout that period of time, from 1607, when Virginia was established under the Stuart kings, until 1763, the British were occupied with other things on their minds, internal problems and then international problems. When these things seemed solved, Parliament is now supreme at home, and England is now supreme abroad. France and Spain have been defeated in the New World. France is out of Canada. Spain is out of Cuba and Florida. And so England is now dominant. And so attention is now focused on the American colonies. And they're going to be administered in the same way that other colonies are going to be are administered. And this is enunciated in Blackstone. Blackstone's Commentaries on the Laws, published four volumes, 1765 to 1769. And in that first volume, Blackstone enunciates the supremacy of Parliament and the fact that the American colonies are now to be administered as we administer conquered nations. So America is not a conquered nation, but it's going to be administered that way. It's not going to be on an even basis. It's going to be administered as colonies. And as colonies, they're going to pay the taxes that they should be paying. All the way previously, there have been taxes applied. Navigation laws were passed and import duties laid, but the Americans were adroit at smuggling. And they didn't pay the duties that the British wanted. Well, now that was going to change. And so you get a whole new policy established. And what happens is a series of events takes place that provoke the conflict between the colonies and Great Britain that leads to the American Revolution. What the Americans, their interpretation was, is that we're a separate country, really, and that the only thing that ties us with Great Britain is our connection with the king. We are loyal. We share the same king. We're loyal to the king, King George III. And in fact, Thomas Jefferson writes a draft pamphlet, a draft petition that he submits to the Virginia House of Burgesses in 1774. This is to be approved and then sent to the First Continental Congress, and they hopefully will send this petition to the king. It's a wonderful petition. It is so radical that the House of Burgesses rejects it. But a friend of Jefferson got sick on the way to the House of Burgesses and gave the petition to a friend. When the petition was rejected, the friend had it published as a pamphlet. Well, thank you very much for making me a traitor. This petition is so radical, it's just wonderful to read. This commoner, Thomas Jefferson, addresses the king and says that kings are the servants, not the proprietors of the people, and that the king ought to be doing what is just and what is right, and that the king here in this particular case ought to intervene with Parliament and with the ministers to tell them to change the policies. Otherwise, who knows what's going to happen? The king, you are our last hope, Jefferson says, to intervene. And the king was viewed in that way as a benevolent individual who could save this empire from fracturing. The king turned a deaf ear to the petition and to the pamphlet. I mean, he was hostile to the pamphlet. How can a commoner tell me what to do? I am the king. And so the king declared Americans in a state of rebellion. And you get the American Revolution. That's how you go from 1774, when the king is benign, loved, to being the great villain in the Declaration of Independence. What they do is they, just in that blink of an eye, when they declare their independence, it's the one individual who's the villain. They change it from the Parliament and the ministers as being the only guilty party. They're going to be complicitory in this, to be sure, but it's the king who has violated our rights. And so, in the Declaration of Independence that Jefferson writes, there's a five-man committee, some old-timers on there. Benjamin Franklin is about 7 years old. John Adams is in his 40s. You have Roger Sherman, who's about 60. And Robert R. Livingston, who's about 40 at this time. But the fifth member is Thomas Jefferson, 33 years old. But they all know what he wrote, that pamphlet 2 years earlier, and how eloquent he was in that pamphlet. And they also wanted to get the Southerners to write this Declaration of Independence. I mean, the first part is such a wonderful document. Jefferson took all of that literature that he found in England during the 17th century. He took all of that and condensed it into five sentences, 202 words, the American philosophy of government, introduced by the what I think is the single most important sentence written in the English language. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. When Jefferson finished that, he went on to the Bill of Indictment against the king. And he listed 29 things that the king had done. And he introduced each one by "he has." And it's a crescendo building up. He has, he has, he has. He's done all these things. He doesn't just list these in a grocery list, which would get tedious. But he lists them in this poetic fashion. And he doesn't list them necessarily in the specifics. He doesn't want the specifics to be denied. And so he talks in very general terms, really, and sometimes in euphemistic terms. And then he says he has also combined with others, that is with Parliament and with the ministers. And then he also attacks the British people for turning away from the plight of Americans. And then he says what we have done. These are the things that we have done. And we separate ourselves. So here we see in the Declaration of Independence a fear of executive authority and how the Constitution, the English Constitution, can be violated. The American Revolution, as I alluded to before, was a very conservative revolution. The lawyers were brought out to show that the Americans were not the rebels. It was the English ministers and the Parliament who were violating the English Constitution. And the Americans were only trying to enforce the Constitution, to maintain the rights that were embodied in the English Constitution. And so this was an uprising against the executive abuse of power. And so the Declaration of Independence is a formal declaration that the executive authority should not go to the extremes that it went to in this particular case. When the Americans, even before the Americans adopted the Declaration of Independence, Congress had suggested to colonial leaders that they establish new constitutions, that the original charters that they had, the original governments that they had, were no longer sufficient to govern them. And many of them were still being controlled by loyalists. So create new constitutions. At the same time, when Richard Henry Lee in Congress stood up on the 7th of June, 1776, and advocated independence, he also advocated that there be a committee established to write Articles of Confederation that would tie the colonies together. And so you get this kind of constitution making going on through the country at the colony level and at the federal level. At the state level, there is real fear of the executive. They've had the experience of English kings. They've had the experience of their own colonial governors, many of them appointed by the crown. And so when they create their new constitutions, they give lip service to the idea of separation of powers. And in most of the state constitutions, you do have a separation of powers as far as what is on paper. That is, you have legislatures, you have executives, and you have judiciaries. Under the English system, the judiciary is part of the executive. And so you have executive and the legislature. But what these state constitutions do is they strip the governors of most of their powers. What you see is in 1776, there's a debate over what is the proper form of constitution for a country. And it starts off with Thomas Paine, who writes Common Sense, this Englishman who comes over in November 1774, a failure at everything he did in his life in England, And now he comes over and he becomes an American. I would love to write a book called Becoming American. When did these people become American? When did George Washington become an American? When did John Adams become an American? When did they cease to be Englishmen or cease to be Virginians? They all had to make that choice. Thomas Paine said in Common Sense, when he wrote this pamphlet, January 1776, we should have a continental government and state constitutions that are very democratic. We should have no anti-majoritarian principles at all. We have the two-thirds majority necessary in the Senate to adopt treaties. We don't need anything like that. Simple majority is what Paine wants. No governors, only a single house assemblies. That's all we need. Real authority of the people, elected annually. Whatever the people want, the people get. Two of the first constitutions, Pennsylvania and Georgia, adopt that system. Unicameral assemblies, no governors, and John Adams is quite frightened by this. And he publishes, he writes a letter first, outlining what he thinks is the best way to form a new constitution. And he writes these letters to Virginians and North Carolinians, and they said, this is wonderful. You should publish this as a pamphlet so that all Americans see this. But don't sign your name, because everybody thinks you're so obnoxious that will diminish the value of what you say. And so he publishes what is called Thoughts on Government, short pamphlet, wonderful pamphlet, in which he calls for a balanced government, separation of powers, real authority in the governor and in the judiciary, as well as in the legislature. He quotes a well-known English authority about the government. A couplet, for forms of government, let fools contest. That which is best administered is best. So it doesn't make any difference what the form is. It's the administration that counts. And he says in this pamphlet, John Adams says, I've never heard anything so ridiculous in all my life. It does make a difference what form you have. The form is important. Every constitution has to be suited for the people that it's established for. You cannot get away from that. Therefore, the American Constitution is good for us and is not necessarily good for anybody else, but it's good for us. You have to have the right form for the people. And so John Adams advocated that. And you see what happens is that the early state constitutions that are formed follow the Paine model, the real democratic kinds of constitution. The later constitutions follow the John Adams model. And there you have more power given to the executive, not a lot of power, but a little bit more power than in those early state constitutions. In the New York Constitution, you have somewhat of a veto power. In fact, it's the progenitor of the veto power that the president has. What this power is it creates a council of revision. The council of revision is made up in New York of the governor, the chancellor, who's the chief equity judge, and the Supreme Court, three judges, five people on this council. Every bill that's passed by the legislature, bicameral legislature, every bill passed by this legislature has to go to the council. And the council has 10 days to consider the bill. And if a majority agree on reasons why they object to the bill is vetoed and goes back to the assembly that instituted it, and it can be overridden by a two-thirds vote. And if both houses override it, then it becomes law. That's 1777 when that constitution is established. 3 years later, when the Massachusetts Constitution is established, they take the basic principles of the Constitution Council of Revision, but they give it to the governor alone. And when the Constitutional Convention comes along, 7 years after that, 1787, they adopt the Massachusetts principle. And that's how we get the veto power for the president. But I mention this because in the Constitutional Convention, James Madison as the primary delegate. Everyone, historians say that James Madison is the father of the Constitution. Madison denied it. My major professor, Merrill Jensen, denied it. He said that there's no father of the Constitution. There's a half a dozen uncles. And James Madison was one of those uncles. And Madison strongly advocated a council of revision. The other thing that you find in these state constitutions is that there are term limits for the governors. Sometimes term limits for the members of the legislature going on simultaneously now with the states forming their constitutions. Congress is drafting a federal constitution, and it takes them a year and a half to draft the Articles of Confederation. They're waging war at this time, so they're quite busy in all the activities involved in war and in negotiating treaties and assistance from abroad. So it takes them a year and a half. And then it takes the American people through their states 3.5 years to adopt the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation is thought to be somewhat like a diplomatic body coming together. Article 2 of the Articles of Confederation was the heart of this document. And it said that the states retain their sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and that Congress only had those powers that were expressly delegated to it by the Articles of Confederation itself. There is no separate executive under the Articles of Confederation. And except for a very small judiciary, an appellate court for prizes and captures of ships, there's no judiciary either. So it's a single house, Congress. And it only had those expressly delegated powers. So it was very limited in what it could do. But it did have significant powers. It had the power to declare war. It had the power to enter into treaties. Didn't have the power to enforce treaties. It had the power to borrow money. Didn't have the power to tax people. It could ask for support from the states. It could ask the states to raise troops. But it didn't have the authority to get it to individuals. It was a confederation. And as a confederation, the Congress could deal only with states. It could not deal with people. And therefore, there was no need for a federal Bill of Rights because Congress could not violate the rights of individuals. It could only act on the states. The states, many of them did have Bills of Rights that protected the rights of individuals from their legislatures, from their governors. But the Articles of Confederation did not have a Bill of Rights because it was felt there was no threat to the liberties of individuals from any kind of executive or legislative power, for that matter. There was a provision for rotation in office. You could only serve 3 years in any six. And then you were out. You had to stay out for 3 years. Congress had, even before the Articles of Confederation, had an antipathy toward an executive. And they were going to do everything themselves. So they created extensive committees. John Adams was on over 30 committees. They worked very hard. Some of these committees were very important committees. The War Committee, Finance Committee, Foreign Affairs Committee. They did not function well as committees of Congress. And so what Congress did was to create the great departments, Department of Finance, Department of War, and Department of Foreign Affairs. And each had a secretary or superintendent who was not a member of Congress. And so we're diverging here from the parliamentary system. The Articles of Confederation was very much like the parliament, except with no king and with no House of Lords. And so here we get a committee system. And what happens is, because of the custom in England, the First Lord of the Treasury, the Secretary of the Exchequer, is usually the Prime Minister. Or you could say the prime minister is usually the first lord of the treasury, one way or the other. It's that position that is usually held by the prime minister at this time. And so what happens in America, Robert Morris becomes superintendent of finance. He becomes prime minister de facto of America. Congress is coming and going. They're in session only about 4 months out of the year. They don't have that continuing service because of the rotation in office. So you don't have ongoing leadership. And here you get Robert Morris, one of the wealthiest merchants in the country from Philadelphia. And he is there 12 months out of the year. Everything funnels through Robert Morris, whether it deals with finance or other matters. He is the prime minister. And people are worried about him. He wants to be emperor. And so when one too many times Robert Morris says, you do it my way or I'm going to quit. They said, quit. And he did. And in, what did they do? The fear was so great that they didn't appoint a replacement. They appointed a board of treasury. They created a board of treasury, a three-man board, one from the New England states, one from the middle states, and one from the southern states. This was to diffuse power so that you wouldn't have this executive authority that was so dangerous. You wouldn't have another Cromwell. And so what happens is there's a void, a political void of leadership, and it's John Jay, Secretary for Foreign Affairs, who assumes the leadership as Prime Minister of the United States. And he is, in fact, Prime Minister for the next 4.5 years. People trusted him. He had a sense of, just as Robert Morris was viewed as a merchant and as being greedy for power and wanting authority, Jay had a sense of morality about him. And people trusted him. And so there was less fear of his authority than Robert Morris's authority. And so that's what we had under the Articles of Confederation. A weak central government with no specific, no designated executive. And it was, quite frankly, an ineffective government. Well, they see the problems developing in the country, and they call a Constitutional Convention. George Washington was elected to that convention by the legislature. He turned it down. He was pressured to attend by his colleagues, James Madison, Edmund Randolph, and others, and he kept on turning it down. And finally, he was convinced he had to go. He wrote to two of his old Revolutionary War subordinates, David Humphreys in Connecticut, who had been an aide-de-camp to Washington, and Humphreys said, no, don't go. The convention is obviously going to fail. And if it fails, your image will be tarnished. What we need is a military takeover. And so once the convention fails, the army will come to the fore and you will be our leader. You are our last stake. So don't go. He wrote to Henry Knox, who had been Washington's head of artillery and was now secretary at war under the Confederation. And Knox wrote back to Washington saying, don't go. If you believe that the convention will do a patchwork job, we need much more. We need a new constitution. But if you go, you'll be elected president of the convention. And if we come up with a new constitution, and if that constitution is adopted, you will have doubly earned the title father of your country. Now, Washington couldn't refuse. You see this in the letter. It's wonderful. He's writing, and in capital letters, he says, father of your country, in all capital letters. So Washington agrees to go. The Constitutional Convention comes together, and they debate all the issues of government. The very first day of debate, the Virginia Plan is put forth by Edmund Randolph, and it calls for a revolution. The very next day, the second day of debate, They say, this is a revolution. We were called to amend the Articles, just to amend.
Now, was George Washington there?
Yes, he was there, and he was elected president. I mean, it's a wonderful story how that happens. Washington is going to come and be a delegate, and Robert Morris, living in Philadelphia, the great merchant, now retired from the superintendency of the finance, and he says to Washington, stay with us at our house, at our mansion. Washington says, no. He doesn't stay with friends. He doesn't want to inconvenience them, nor does he want to play favorites. And so he always stays in public inns whenever he goes any place. And that's why he slept around a lot. Washington slept here, Washington slept there. But he told Morris, no, I'm going to stay at a public inn. And so when he arrives in Philadelphia, he's ready to go into the public inn there, and there are the Morrises with their carriage. And they want to take his bag. You're coming with us. Stay with us. No, I'm saying, no, you're coming with us. And it's creating a scene. And finally, Washington says, okay, I'll go with you. And so they load up the carriage, and they're ready to go. And shock to the Morrises, Washington is not going with them. They take the bags and go to their home. But you know where Washington goes? He goes to visit Benjamin Franklin, the diplomatic hero of the American Revolution. He pays homage to Franklin. He's 81 years old. He's sick, very ill, with the gout. I don't know if any of you have had the gout. I've had the gout recently, and I really sympathize with these people who've had the gout. But also he has other problems. But Washington goes and pays his respect to the diplomatic hero of the Revolution. When the convention finally gets a quorum and they meet the first day, Benjamin Franklin stays home. And he stays home because there's only two people who could be elected president of the convention, Washington and Franklin. And Franklin stays home so that Washington gets the nomination. Robert Morris, the only time he speaks in the convention, nominates Washington to be president of the convention. And Washington is elected president of the convention. And he presides. He doesn't preside all the time. For about the first month and a half, 2 months of the convention, they sit as a committee of the whole. And he's not chairman of the committee of the whole. And so he could speak if he wanted to. He's in the Virginia delegation. But Washington never speaks. Not until the very end of the convention does Washington speak on the issues. Well, as I said, they discussed lots of things. Washington did not participate in this. Partly because he realized what his position was, that in all likelihood he would be asked to be the first president. And so he didn't want to be advocating additional powers for the presidency, to be later accused of feathering his own nest. And so we get these powers that are proposed for the presidency. Madison says it was the most difficult issue we had to resolve. Presidency. Of all the different issues that they faced, the presidency was the most difficult to come up with. What James Madison wanted was, among other things, he wanted the Council of Revision to be established. He had two big issues that he failed on. The first was he wanted a congressional veto over all state laws. He didn't even have the support of his own delegation for that. The Virginia Plan call for a congressional veto over acts that were in contravention of the federal Constitution. But Madison wanted more than that. Madison wanted the congressional veto over all acts of the state legislatures. Why did he want that? Well, Madison, I think, my interpretation of Madison, which I have in my chapbook, is different than most other people. Most of the people, they look at Madison, and they try to say, why did he change? Why was he a nationalist at one time, a states writer at another time, and vacillating at different times? Well, I think Madison doesn't vacillate from the primary principle that he's looking at, and that is protection of rights, liberty and justice. That's the subtitle of my biography of Madison. Champion of liberty and justice. Whenever he saw the abuse of liberty and justice, he entered the fray in support of those who needed support, whether it be against the British in the American Revolution, whether it be against Culpeper County when they threw Baptist ministers in jail because they violated the law in preaching without licenses, whether it be against the states for violating the rights of individuals during the Confederation period, and he wanted a strong national government. He didn't want a strong national government because he was a nationalist. He wanted a strong national government because the states were abusing the rights of individuals. And those rights that I'm talking about, I'm not talking about, all too often people are mistaken when they see the rights of the minority are endangered by the majority. This being said back in the 1780s. What that means is not blacks that their rights are being violated. Certainly we have slavery. That's part of the system. But that's not what they're talking about. We're not talking about the rights of women. These are not the issue concern. It's the rights of the minority, the rights of the wealthy. They're the minority at this time. It's the rights of the minority, of the wealthy, that are being violated by the states, with paper money being issued so that it would depreciate. You can pay off your debts more easily. State laws and violations of contracts. These are the things that are detrimental to creditors and to the wealthy. And so that's what Madison is trying to protect. And the way he's doing this, because he cannot control the state constitutions, is to have this national government, this new national government, come in and take control. Whatever law that would be passed, whether it was in violation of the federal constitution or whether it violated the rights of individuals, could be vetoed. He says that's the minimum that we can get by with. Such a thing would never have passed, and it wasn't adopted by the Constitutional Convention. Madison was very disheartened because of that. At the federal level, he knew he could get on top of things, as he couldn't get on top of things in the states. And so what he did at the federal level was, through the architecture of the plan, through the structure of the Constitution, he was going to protect rights. And so you're going to have separation of powers among the branches. You're going to have division of powers, some powers to the states, some powers to the federal government. You're going to have checks and balances so that you wouldn't have a complete separation of powers. A complete separation of powers would give you total gridlock. What the founding fathers wanted was mild gridlock. They didn't want things to go along rapidly. They wanted things to go along slowly. In the Pennsylvania Constitution, as radical as it was, single house assembly, annual elections, this is productive of real revolutionary kind of activities. There was a provision that no law could be passed until there was a waiting period. So you have a bill introduced, you had to wait to the next session before you could pass that law. That would be the slowing down process, the simmering, and let the passions of the people calm down. Well, what Madison wanted was to create this kind of a government with structures so that the separation of powers would take place, but the powers wouldn't be totally separated where there'd be a standoff. But there'd be give and take, and what should be done is that the individual who holds the office should be given the opportunity to defend his position, the government position. That is, he says, ambition should be made to fight ambition. He says that's a bad commentary on government, isn't it? A bad commentary on individual. But what is government? Government is there because individuals are who they are, because human nature is what it is. People will abuse their authority, and therefore we must have government. And so when you have government, you must allow the various constitutional officers to protect their turf so that the president should be able to protect his turf from Congress and from the judiciary. But Congress should protect his turf from the president and judiciary and so forth. And so that's what Madison wants to do structurally. He says, in one of the few times that he was eloquent, Madison is not an eloquent writer. He is a detailed writer. We'll have a 3-page letter from Madison, and we want to abstract it. The abstract becomes 5 pages long. Because it's so detailed, so concise. He doesn't have the poetry of a Thomas Jefferson. And that's why I think James Madison is not so well known as Thomas Jefferson. But Madison says in the Federalist number 51, if men were angels, there would be no need for government. If angels were governed, there'd be no need for external or internal restraints. But he says, in creating a constitution, the first thing that must be done is to give the government the authority to govern the people. But in the second place, you must oblige the government to control itself. That's the problem. Yeah. How do you get government to control itself? And he says it's not through a Bill of Rights. Now, he says that at that time because the Constitution had no Bill of Rights. And he's advocating, adopt this Constitution, then maybe later on we'll get a Bill of Rights. But at the present time, it is absolutely necessary that we adopt this Constitution. Same way with slavery. He hated slavery. And the Constitution did nothing to eliminate slavery. And his attitude was, okay, let's get the Constitution first. We'll address the slavery question later. And so you have to be pragmatic in this approach. And he says, okay, what we need, usually, he says, historically, the way we control government was through elections. Someone violated their authority, we kick the rascals out. But it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. What we need, he said, are auxiliary precautions. And that's where this structure comes in. That's why he wanted this veto power over the states, so that he can then control what they're doing and they wouldn't violate the rights of individuals because the Congress would check that authority. The Council of Revision, he advocates also that the president should combine with some of the judges and create this council and have a veto power. He wants the judges involved right away. He wrote a wonderful letter of the 8th of April, 1787, in which he outlines what he wants for the convention. The convention is going to begin in May. So this is about a month ahead of time. He writes this letter. He writes to Washington and Edmund Randolph and to Edmund Pendleton. But this is a letter to Edmund Randolph. And Madison writes to Randolph, and Randolph writes to Washington, and Washington writes to Madison. And whenever Madison or Washington writes to Randolph, they always say, great idea, great idea. But when Madison and Washington write, they say, what a boob this Randolph is. He doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. And he does it most of the time. And so Madison outlines everything in this letter to Randolph, what he wants. Randolph says, I've been thinking about this, giving a lot of attention, and I think we ought to take the Articles of Confederation, get rid of the bad parts, and put some new parts in. And Madison says, no, we ought to throw out the whole Articles of Confederation, start from scratch, and then take some of the good things out of the Articles of Confederation. Different method here. But one of the things he says is we should have a second house. And that second house should be much smaller and should have a different constituency, whether it be the elite or, in this case, the election by the state legislatures, so that it will diffuse the dangerous democratic element that's in the House of Representatives. And so the question is, how far do you go in giving powers to the Senate? And that's one of the powers that they give, is the power to amend money bills. Another power, they give this power over treaties. Another power is the power over appointments. These are powers that are usually reserved not for the Senate, but for a privy council, so that there would be responsibility. Governor Morris, not related to Robert Morris, but connected with him politically. He was the person who actually wrote the Constitution. You know, people will ask you, who wrote the Constitution? There are two answers to that. What do you mean? Do you mean the actual words that are there? And that was Governor Morris. He was the one, not chairman of the Committee of Style, 5-man committee, but he's a great writer. and he is given the job. Here's all the things that passed, all the resolutions that we have. Write it out now as a constitution. And he wrote the preamble to the constitution. Up until this time, the preamble to the constitution said, we the states of so-and-so. He's the one who changed it to we the people. Uh-huh. And he's just a great, great writer. It took the Constitutional Convention 4 months to draft the Constitution. It took the American people 9 months to ratify it. Documenting that, it'll take us 65 years to document that ratification process. And we've got about another 10 more years to go. But Washington and Morris were very close friends, even though there's a considerable difference in age. Washington's 55, Morris is 37 at the Constitutional Convention. But they went off together when the convention adjourned for recess for 10 days, gave the a committee of detail, this is in late July, gave them the opportunity to bring together what had been accepted in the form of a constitution, the first draft of the constitution. Washington had his itinerary all planned. He couldn't go home, it was too far away for him to go home. But Elizabeth Powell, the wife of the first mayor of Philadelphia, was Washington's social secretary. She had everything planned for him, the dinners and the plays and all that. And Morris says, let's go fishing. Well, Washington says, I can't do that. I'm committed. I've got to stay here. I know this wonderful trout stream. It's on my brother-in-law's farm. And Washington was a great fisherman. Governor Morris said to Washington, it's very close to Valley Forge. Very close to Valley Forge. Well, Washington could not pass that by. And so they went fishing the first day, Washington says, with little success. The next day, Morris went fishing, and Washington went to Valley Forge. 10 years since that terrible winter that they suffered. And it was all overgrown with grass and leaves. And it was a very meaningful time for Washington, an emotional time. He spent the whole day there. And then he came back home. And on the way home to the Morris's brother-in-law's house, he saw three farmers in the field. And he stopped, got off his horse, jumped over the fence, and introduced himself. And so, my name is George Washington. What are you doing? And can you imagine these farmers? And they explained to him they were planting buckwheat. And he took down all this information and he wrote it to his nephew and said, plant buckwheat. But I always wondered what these farmers said to their wives that evening. I tell them what they had done. They talked with Washington. Anyway, it's Governor Morris who wrote the Constitution. And then I'll end with this point. It's one of my pet peeves, I think. What they wanted with this Privy Council was responsibility. And what they meant by that was when ministers in England gave bad advice, whether it be on treaties, whether it be going to war, they had to bear responsibility, which meant execution. Now, I consider that responsibility. But all too often, I see in our governments, whether it's the state level or the national level, we see the national executive, the state executive, saying they take responsibility. When the bombing took place in Lebanon and 250 Marines were killed, Ronald Reagan said it's his responsibility. But nothing happened. When we just saw the President of the United States standing up and said, yes, there have been problems in Iraq. I take the responsibility. What does that mean? Nothing happens. And so that's what these people wanted, was responsibility in government. So thank you very much.
Audio recordings of this and other thought-provoking programs are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speaker and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute.